Welcome to the ISF podcast from the Information Security Forum. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert, and I'm glad to welcome you back to our program, featuring cutting-edge conversations with business leaders and creative luminaries tailored to global security professionals. In this episode, ISF CEO Steve Durbin and I discuss our theme this season, the security workforce of the future. Over the next several weeks, and with a variety of guests, we'll focus on what enterprises can do to attract, retain, and train the talent they'll need to manage the demands of security in the coming years. Human-centered security is something that you come back to again and again that is in your interest and that I believe you see as not just interesting, but integral to growing a business and maintaining a healthy, robust workforce. What has maintained your particular interest in it? You know, we've been talking about that for a couple of years now. So what is it that brings you back to that topic again and again and keeps that topic evergreen in your mind?
It's the fact that there's one thing that never changes, and that is your ability to correctly predict how people behave. So many people have tried and many people have failed and many people will continue to follow exactly that same road. And I think that from this security standpoint, if you look at what security tries to do, security loves things that are predictable, that it can anticipate ideally. And so people fit outside of that realm. And you hear a lot about zero trust and all that kind of thing as the way to go from a security standpoint, but you can't apply that to people. So, you know, if you zero trust any of your people, then you might as well pack up and go home. You have no business. And of course, you know, zero trust doesn't mean that you don't trust. It just means that you make an assumption that something that can go wrong will go wrong. But even then, within a people environment, that doesn't work well. It doesn't sit well with my view of a trusting culture, a flexible culture, a culture that has a broad mix of generations, that's highly diverse, that's agile, that encourages people to question, to challenge, because that's how you build a thriving business, in my view. So I think that when we talk about human-centered, or when I talk about human-centered, the reason I keep coming back to it is that there is a constant need to reevaluate how security can best work with people. And if you look at the way that things changed during the pandemic with home working, for instance, or remote working, and the way in which that is probably set to remain for some organizations, not all, but certainly for some, then we've moved security into a realm over which it has not just limited control, but I would say zero control. So you have to fall back on understanding better how you can work with the people who are remote from you, how you can help them to do the best when they come to work in a way that fits in with the policies and the risk posture that an organization has. So that's why I keep coming back to it, because for me, everything begins and ends with people. Even if you introduce a high degree of artificial intelligence and machine learning into your processes, you will still have to deal with people in some way, shape, or form. It's a constant. And that's why I keep coming back to it. Because we haven't cracked it. I don't think we ever will. And I think we have to keep working at it.
Do you think it's getting farther away? Or do you think the idea of centering human psychology and human behavior is becoming more standard in security?
I don't think it's possible to say. I think that in some organizations, it's being more openly embraced than in others. You know, if you look at just some of the stuff that we produced for our Threat Horizon report, you know, you look at the work overload that security departments are under, you look at the amount of compliance that they have, you look at the amount of policies that they have, you look at what they have to do when they respond to potential attacks and so on. And then you throw into the mix something like human psychology. It's very, very different from where a lot of them currently are. Now, you know, we can debate whether or not they should be focused in a different direction, but it will very much depend on the kind of organization that you happen to be working in. And I would suggest perhaps some of the line of business that you happen to be in as well. So I don't think it's a one size fits all. I think what we do know, though, is that if you're going to have security being recognized as adding value to your business, then you have to move away from a reliance on pure technology to get your message across. So you have to be able to articulate the value that you bring to the business, not just in the boardroom, but in every single individual department that you touch. And so an understanding of the way that people operate, the way that people take on board messages, the way that they like perhaps to be involved, understanding the dynamic of an organization becomes increasingly more important. And that's why we're seeing a lot more chief information security officers, not just having security skills, but having other more people-based skills as well. Because you can train some of that in, but actually it's a lot easier if you've got people who are coming from perhaps other parts of the business that are moving into security that bring some of those ideas with them to challenge some of the ways that security has been done in the past. And I think that that's the really important piece. You know, it's that constructive challenge of the way that we're running security, because it continues to change very, very rapidly based on the way that we use technology, the way that we run our businesses, and the different risk paradigms and landscapes that we have to really navigate.
So we're bringing a season 4, conversations all about the workforce of the future. And is that through line then humans? I mean, it's not technology. Our conversations may touch on technology, but never going to be about the technology itself. It's all about the use of it, the applications of it.
I think it's about people, yes. I think it's about the different things that we have to do to enable people to give of their best, to reduce the potential for a security breach, security mistakes, if you like. And that goes everywhere from, you know, training. And so when we talk to Thomas Earle, for instance, you know, there's a really interesting perspective he brings to what he terms vendor neutral training. We talk about disruption, we talk about digital transformation, you know, these sorts of terms are bandied around a lot, but you can't get away from the fact that in that kind of constantly changing environment, you need to keep abreast of what's going on. So training takes on a whole new importance, if you like. And over the last 12 months, you know, that has been difficult to achieve because people haven't been able to do it in person. And so it's something else that's been added to the screen workload. And so I think that, you know, having some form of regular training that people can fall back on that reinforces some of those security messages is really important. And we have to continually look at ways in which we can provide that in bite-sized chunks that people can very easily consume, that's acceptable to them.
So training is a big part. I know that we have a conversation with Margaret Cunningham that centers a lot around people's well-being and health. So you just mentioned that the workload has increased since the pandemic.
Yeah.
In the midst of these really seismic changes in how work is accomplished, how teams come together, we are overloaded more than ever. Talk a little bit about that from your perspective. You're the leader of an organization and you're dealing with your talent pool's needs, not only for training, but for support that I imagine is new ways of supporting your team, new ways of cultivating health and well-being in your talent pool.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we have a globally dispersed team and we have a globally dispersed membership, you know, and one of the things we always said that we would do throughout the pandemic is to do our best to continue to deliver in line with what we'd promised to members. That's the sort of the front part of it, you know, the market facing piece. In order to do that, though, you've got to look after the people within the organization as well. And I don't know that we've got it right every time. I think what we've done is we've tried a number of different things. I think that's one of the pieces that has been different. You know, Margaret talks about leading a home working team and some of the communication skills requirements and that kind of thing. I think for me, it's been about how do you remain in touch with people? How do you really provide them with direction? And I don't mean that in a very sort of prescriptive way. I mean, everybody, you know, is worried, obviously, about their future. You know, will the business continue to operate? You know, we've seen so many businesses go to the wall during the pandemic. People, it's a natural concern for people. So when I talk about direction, it's about just keeping them abreast of how we're doing as an organization, where we are going, where we need more help. But we've also more recently started to focus on mental health and well-being, because that's been a big concern of mine as well. You know, people have been working remotely, certainly in the UK, which is where a lot of our people are, for 12 months, maybe more. And so we've started things like desk yoga, for instance, that's just started at lunchtimes that people anywhere in the world actually can join in. we've taken out a corporate subscription for Headspace so that people can meditate and that kind of thing. We encourage people through different competitions and things that we have to count the number of steps they do on a daily basis. And so we've got different leagues and that kind of thing. So it's a whole variety of different stuff, you know, and then there's coffee hours. And the point is, what we're trying to do is to continually mix up and recreate a sense of belonging, a sense of ISF culture in an environment where it's very difficult for people to get together. And, you know, some of them won't have seen, you know, if I think about the people that we've got, say, in India or in North America, you know, we won't have seen those for what could be 18 months, maybe longer, by the time this whole pandemic is over.
Did those ideas come from the younger staff? I'm just curious. I feel like Generation Z gets a bad rap sometimes, often, because my perception of them is that they know what they want. They know what they need or what would improve their quality of life, their quality of work, and they expect it. And I wonder if that's accurate. If your younger staff, which I know you have a very diverse workforce at ISF, are your younger staff members leading the charge, asking for these creative ways of connecting, these creative ways of improving mental health? Is that coming from them?
Whether the idea came from, you know, somebody who happened to be a Generation Z or Y or whatever, I don't know. What I do know is that it's been a much more of a collective response. And I think that that is very valuable, because if you can create a collective response and a collective way of going about doing things, you don't tend to leave people behind. And it's very, very easy in a remote environment to leave people behind because you don't see them. And they may participate in some of the company, you know, calls, but maybe the camera isn't off. Maybe they don't have the time to, or maybe they're just afraid to put forward some of the ideas that they might have. So the role of the team itself takes on an added importance. Mm. And I think I've certainly seen that. But this sort of, you know, juxtapositioning of different age groups, different ideas, for me is hugely healthy. I would love to continue to be able to have an environment where that happens. And, you know, one of the sessions we've got coming up that people can listen to is that sort of maybe not as strong as that from a juxtapositioning standpoint, but certainly different views from Generation Z. Obviously, we've got Mahak Vora, who is part of that generation, who talks about how she has gone about, you know, starting businesses and some of the expectations, to your point around privacy and so on. And then we have Rich Guido, who's an exceptionally gifted and experienced former CISO. He was the VP at Johnson & Johnson, and yet hugely innovative as well. So, you know, you've got a whole combination of things that are going on there in that little melting pot episode, if you like. And I'd like to think that the ISF, we take ideas from both ends of the generational scale, if I could put it that way, mix them all up and then come up with the sorts of things that I was just talking about.
I love the conversation with Rich Guida because he is so experienced and yet he has such a fresh, curious, almost playful energy about him where he's open to new ideas, open to new possibilities. There's nothing staid or, you know, this is the way it's done and that's the end of the conversation with him. He's so open-minded, open-hearted.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that that is the way that security has to be in the future. You know, and he was doing it way back when he was at J&J. But I think that we have to bring a bit more fun into what we do from a security standpoint, not in a frivolous way necessarily. But, you know, I think that we can run the risk of moving into quite a sort of staid and hugely corporate type approach to security. And I don't think that that is the way to go. I think that there's no fun in that. We need to have more fun in security.
You have talked about that people can get left behind.
Yeah.
And especially in this environment, easier than ever to leave people behind. But it takes time and energy to care. And I think the idea for me of the cold corporate culture is just churn and burn. You know, if this person is left behind or they can't keep up or they're having mental health issues or they're overwhelmed with pandemic increases in screen time, there are 30 others that you can hire. So why slow down enough to really think that that person matters?
it's not a philosophy that I've ever had. You know, this sort of, if people can't catch up, you just leave them behind. I mean, there are organizations out there that clearly have that kind of approach, and there's no need to mention them. People know that the sorts of companies that are out there, particularly in financial services. And I think for some people, that suits the way that they want to work. And so I'm not going to, you know, sit here and criticize another company's way of working or culture if that works for them and their shareholders. But it's not a company that I would particularly want to run. It's not a company that I would want to be part of. I do think that if you run a company, doesn't matter what size, then as the leader in that organization, you have a responsibility to a whole variety of people, the people that you employ, obviously, your shareholders, your stakeholders, and indeed yourself, to make the best of whatever comes your way. So again, you know, if you look at the pandemic, the key thing that I particularly wanted to achieve throughout that was that, as I've said, we'd continue to deliver to our customers, our members. We would continue to provide employment for everybody that worked for us through our supply chains as well, where that was possible. And the goal that we had last year was to make sure that we finished the year with the same people that we started it with, unless they wanted to go somewhere else, you know, and that's absolutely fine as well. So we didn't, I had no intention of ever furloughing or anything like that. And that's my job. That's my responsibility. It isn't anybody else's. And then you move beyond that and you see the way that things are going to be coming out the other side. And then you begin to look at how you can continue to grow, invest in people, develop them and so on. And those are, you know, the really important elements of any, I think, leadership role. And of course, you know, you have to make sure that you're delivering the revenues and so on that allows for that. But we come back again to the fact that the majority, I think the vast majority of organizations today continue to be people businesses, whether or not they recognize it as such is a different thing. But they will survive or otherwise based on their ability to harness the skills, the mental horsepower, if you like, of their employees to deliver. And so you then have to create the environment that allows for that, irrespective of what is going on outside, because you can't influence what happens outside. You can influence what happens within your organization. And you can do that every single minute of every single day. And that, I think, has been the role of leadership, or should have been the role of leadership throughout the pandemic. And it has changed, obviously, the way in which people work. It has changed the way in which they interact. But again, I think you always have to look for the positives you can take from that. What have we learned? You know, how can we do things better rather than anything else? So I think it's also, and you know, the episode we did with Matthew Doane highlights this, it's also really shone a bit of a light on the fact that we need to continually grow skills. We need to continually provide opportunity for our people to adapt and support them in that adaptation, to give of their best. And Matthew talks a lot about purpose and what the workforce of the future might look like and so on. And I think that we're building towards that. But again, if you assume that you're going to get that right every single time, then you're going to be very disappointed. I never assume that we're going to get it right. I always assume that we're going to make our best of it, you know, give it our best shot. But the key to it for me is about adaptability and about agility and about being really flexible, because we're going to need to be to adapt to post-pandemic remains of a recession and, you know, the tremendous opportunities that will undoubtedly arise on the other side of all of those.
If we could all go back to work tomorrow, get back into the office together, would you continue the initiatives like yoga and meditation? Or are those pandemic response triage efforts that you can let go of later?
No, we'll continue to try different things irrespective of whether we're in the office or on the bus, you know, or the train or the car or wherever it happens to be. I think that for me, there will not be ever a return to what there was before. So the way in which people work will be different. So I think that we will see more flexibility in that. I've said on a number of occasions, you know, that I see absolutely no point in dragging people on public transport or in their cars for, you know, 3-4 hours a day to get to one location to do something that they could equally well do from home. That being said, I do see a need for in-person collaboration to take place. But to your point about mental health, that isn't suddenly all going to go away when the pandemic's over. You know, we're going to have to pick up the pieces from what's been a pretty horrible period for a lot of people. But when we talk about things like desk yoga and Headspace and that kind of stuff, they're things that I think are useful at a certain moment in time. And when that time has passed, we won't do them anymore, but they'll be replaced with something else. But it's not time bound by a return to the office. It's time bound by when they have served their usefulness. And so if everybody decides that that's actually improving the quality of work, then we'll carry on with it. I'm sure there'll be other suggestions and ideas that people come up with as well, you know, along the way. And, you know, we'll consider each and every one of those and no doubt adopt some of them and not others. But no, it's not a pandemic thing. It is more a response to a situation that our people have found themselves in. And we think this might help and could be useful. And if people enjoy it, then we'll carry on with it.
So we have a lot to look forward to this season. Thanks to Steve for his time this week. Next week, we'll be back featuring a conversation between Steve and ISF analyst Dan Norman. The two will discuss an overview of the security profession in today's current climate, as well as how to build a team and a culture to promote secure practices throughout your organization.
And one of the things that always strikes me when I talk to an organization is that they might say to me, we've got a policy that says, you know, you shouldn't click on something. You know, if you think it's looks suspicious, it probably is, don't click on it. And my immediate question is then, well, what do I do? If you've told me not to do something, what am I supposed to do? And the answer, of course, is you need to provide them with the contact where they need to go so that they can have the problem resolved. And so we very often forget that piece. We're very good, I think, at telling people what they shouldn't be doing. But to be much more effective, we need to flip that. And we need to be telling them what they can do so that they can respond appropriately. And we need to make it easy for them as well.
We look forward to bringing you the full conversation next week. In the meantime, we invite you to tune in to our catalog of video and podcast episodes, all of which you can find at securityforum.org. We invite you to follow the audio feed wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd be very grateful if you'd recommend us. Growing our subscriber numbers helps us reach new audiences and helps us continue to bring you these timely discussions. Join in the conversation on our LinkedIn page by searching CEO Steve Durbin or Security Forum. You can also directly download from ISF's website the research, practical tools, and guidance that we discuss in conversations like these. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert. Music by Alexander Filipiak. Associate producer Katie Flood. Mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.